The next day, they were out again, looking at a small meadow tightly surrounded by forest, where two sets of landing tracks had once appeared. At the site, they studied the photographs of the tracks. The grass was not broken, just mashed down. According to witnesses, it stayed that way for weeks. A single set of footprints led to and from each grouping of 3 6-foot pod marks. The elders viewed everything from a perspective of simple logistics. How could it be accomplished? Tools, time, expense, expertise? With the landing tracks, no vehicle could be driven to within 250 feet of the site. Whatever was used to make the tracks would have to be light and compact enough to carry through the woods at least that distance. It would have to be heavy enough to mash tall thick grass perfectly flat, yet light enough for one person to twirl without using a center pivot, for the tracks were smooth all the way across. However the swirling was accomplished, it would have to be carried out from a single point at the edge of one of the circles, for no footprints existed elsewhere. How could such an apparatus be made? How could it be transported? And how do you crush grass so it will never rise again yet remain alive? That night, the elders were back in the warm kitchen, listening to Mia talk more about Earth humans being a younger stage of the Pleiadians' own evolution. That is one of the reasons they study us, said Mia. We represent an earlier part of their society. What does it feel like to be dematerialized? Asked Brit. It is a condition of being well balanced, said Mia. Explain that, please, said Brit. As if you would find yourself in eternity, replied Mia. It starts the moment the dematerialization begins. Does it end when you rematerialize? No, explained Mia, it does not end like that. That condition stays, depending on your own thinking and feeling. You see, he continued, when I leave the ship, I jump into the hole, and into the hole they, what we call, arrange the material. If you leave the ship and lose your material body, you will not realize it in that moment until the body touches some other material thing, like the ground or a tree. When they come out of the ship, asked Brit, are they dematerialized, and do they materialize when they touch the ground? You can't see them, answered Mia. But if they touch the ground, they will materialize. See, here in this hole, he points to one of the photographs. I don't know exactly if it is this one or one of these other two. But it is open here, and when they jump into the hole, they will dematerialize. So when they jump out, said Lee, you don't see them come down, you only see them in here? Yes. Now, when their body forms, is there a whiteness? No. It's just solid. It's just, they're here, and then, they're gone. Yes. There are no stages of development. Mia shook his head. Colonel Stevens once told me that sometimes when you came back you were out of breath, said Lee. Is that true? It's because of the atmosphere we have here, explained Mia, and the atmosphere they have there. They have 32% oxygen. It is better and lighter breathing. The air on board the ship. Yes. Just imagine you are somewhere out in the countryside, and then, you have to go to the city. And this is very fast. Practically a split second from one place to the other. Is there anything you've been told not to discuss? Asked Lee. Mainly things that concern the future, said Mia. Also, not to talk too much about the teachings because man has to think for himself to find out the truth. A lot of what he said had to be taken with a grain of salt, elders said later. It was hard to conceive of. But yet, everything made such logical sense. I think what I focused on was the delivery of what he was saying. Was he emotional? Was he blasé? He was just sitting there as if he were talking about going down to the corner to get a loaf of bread, which made it all appear real, made it very believable. Basically, he made you stop and think, why shouldn't they be like us? Why should they be any different as far as family life or education? And if they're 2 or 3 thousand years more technologically advanced than us, then sure, it would make sense that they carried little devices on their belts that could translate languages instantly. I had to go back to that one phrase he kept saying. They're no different than we are. Mia talked on about civilizations that lived in harmony in the universe and traveled faster than light, about life on Era and the androids and the spiritual leader there, about his childhood experiences with Svath. People came from all over Europe to hear him speak of these things. The elders listened closely to everything Mir said, searching for inconsistency. Not once did Mir contradict himself, nor did he preach or try to sell them merchandise. Though they offered nothing in the way of objective proof, Mir's answers to their questions came patiently and logically. Unobtrusively, in their comings and goings, in their conversations with witnesses, the elders and Stevens explored the farm, the main house and barn, the outbuildings, and the nearby woods, searching for a darkroom, a machine shop, or unusual rigging or equipment. Everything about the farm seemed old and crude, a cover perhaps, but basic necessities for pulling off such a sophisticated show would require at least electricity, and other than the thin wire lighting a few bulbs in the kitchen and living areas, no power lines came to the house or anywhere else on the farm. But Lee Elders kept looking, finally narrowing his search to four closed rooms. One was under the old carriage house where Jacobus slept. There's a room down there. That intrigued me. Another was a storage place to the side of the carriage house. The third area that intrigued me was the basement to the house itself. And the fourth area was Mia's office. I kept wondering, what's in there? One afternoon, under the pretense of an urgent need to speak with Jacobus, Elders engineered a stunt Stevens would never have tried on his own. He dragged Stevens down the steps leading to Jacobus' room beneath the carriage house. We knocked on the door and sort of invited ourselves in, recalled Elders. Immediately, before Jacobus could rise, they combed the room and started babbling in English about farming and the weather and whatever else came to their minds, none of which Jacobus understood. Before he could respond, they had satisfied themselves that Jacobus and his room were clean. Then, they started laughing and shook his hand. Dank, Dankson. Very Spartan conditions, said Elders, nothing abnormal. The second area I got into was the equipment room. This was the side of the carriage house facing the farmhouse, and there was nothing in there except saws and hoes and grass cutters and things like this, a lot of equipment they used around the farm. And then, finally, we got into the basement under the house itself. We just went down one day. It was very easy. You come out the back stairs there, down the concrete steps, and turn to your right and come down the other steps. The door was unlocked. We didn't make it obvious that we were skulking or anything like that, we just walked to the door and opened it. Ah, wonder what's in here, let's see how they store their food, or whatever, walked in, and checked it out. They used it for storing their cabbage and carrots and things like that. There was nothing down there. So except for his office, we had totally explored everything that we could see which might be a hiding place for something. Britt found herself in the office and the room adjacent when Elsie Moser, an English-speaking school teacher, took her back to show her some contact notes and 11x14 blow-ups of the photographs. But there was little to see, a few books, an old typewriter, an old desk with no drawers, two lamps, and a small cactus garden. Nothing odd, wrote Britt in her diary. She even had the Mir children show her parts of the farm, including their rooms. We've seen nothing strange, Britt recorded after a few days at the farm. Leah's in a quandary. It's hard not to like Billy and the others. We must remain objective. After all the evidence that's been presented, not analyzed, presented, Lee still questions all. Steve has no objectivity left. Just wants more and more and more. I'm on overload. Stevens and Elders also got into Mia's office after Stevens asked Mia about the sound made by the beam ships. Stevens had overheard someone at the farm talking about the sounds, but neither he nor Elders knew a tape existed. Mia surprised them by offering to take them back to his study and play the recording for them. Elders turned on his own tape recorder to capture the eerie, warbling, at times piercing sound that, as far as he knew, could have been produced with a synthesizer. But the tape was nothing they could have analyzed back in the States. We were in one of those little crannies the next to his office, said Elders, and there were chickens all through the damned place, and he was playing the sound and we were recording chickens clucking, roosters squawking, and the beamship purring. And it was a total disaster. When we got back, it sounded like we were in a henhouse. So we had to retape them later. After a few days of circulating around the farm and finding nothing suspicious, the only discovery that shocked the elders was how Mia had his evidence organized. He kept everything in the closet and stuffed under drawers, in between mattresses. It was unbelievable. And that first year at the farm, there were no doors to close off, just a little curtain between the living area and the area they slept in. People walked through there all the time. He used to keep these beautiful photographs in shoeboxes under his bed. Several hundred photographs had disappeared. F. Among the witnesses with whom the elders spoke was Herbert Runkel, who told them of the first time he went on a contact with Mia, not the night of the dense fog but an earlier night. Jacobus drove that night, too. When Mia disappeared into the woods, it had been raining, there were puddles on the road, and the trees swayed in the wind. An hour passed as the two men sat in the car at the edge of the forest and talked or walked back and forth to keep warm. They never saw any lights. Nothing, Herbert said to the elders. No animal, no light, no car, nothing. No sounds, no house, no nothing. Only the wind blowing. After an hour and 20 minutes, Mia had returned. I remember when Billy came back, said Herbert. I put my hand on his shoulder, hello, you are back, and I saw his clothes were completely dry. I shook his hand. He was warm. Lee Elders was certain this was merely a trick of some sort. He questioned Herbert. Could Mia have had a shelter in the woods, a small fire going, turned his coat inside out? No, said Herbert, that's impossible because we were always looking around. We looked up at the sky and listened carefully because we wanted to see something or hear something, maybe when a ship rose up. One thing that struck the elders about Herbert was the confusion on his face when he recounted his experiences with Mia. The man obviously was intelligent and well-read, yet he seemed totally perplexed by what he had seen. Often, he would end a story by saying, I am not crazy. I saw that with my own eyes. Elsie Moser taught school in a nearby canton. A warm and intelligent woman of 50 who had lived for 2 years in England and spoke excellent English, Elsie told the elders, if Billy really had contact every time he said he did, I don't know. But he has had contact with extraterrestrials. I am certain of this. One of the little things that had convinced Elsie that the contacts were taking place was a film Mia had shot with his movie camera on a tripod. In the clip, what appears to be a beamship hovers at some distance. Mia himself suddenly comes into the film from the right, the left sleeve of his old green sweater dangling as he walks away from the camera down a path. Then, he stops and, with his right hand, beckons the ship to come closer. But the ship remains in the distance. Mia squats on his haunches, waiting for a minute or two, watching the sky. Once, he looks at the camera and points to the ship, which still moves no closer. Finally, he shrugs, and with a look of disappointment, walks back toward the tripod, as the ship still hovers high in the distance. Elsie told the elders they would have to know German and the Swiss German people to understand this because the disappointment on Mia's face when the ship does not come closer is genuine. Many witnesses had seen strange lights in the sky, perfectly silent lights, sometimes white, sometimes red and yellow and orange, often in twos, and flying crazy patterns. Even more of the witnesses had seen Mia himself do unexplainable things. Harold Prock told the elders about New Year's Eve 1977, a night when Mia and about 10 other people had been sitting around the kitchen table talking. Harold had asked Mia a question about parapsychology, but Mia did not answer directly. He asked if I had a 2-franc piece, recalled Harold. I didn't have one, so Elsie gave one to me. Billy took it and told me to hold his hand. I sat on the opposite side from him. Mia wrapped his fingers around the 2-franc piece, a coin the size of an American half dollar. Harold cupped his hands around Mia's fist. Mia looked at the fist and suddenly, his whole body began to tremble. The table shook, as did Mia's chair. Several people found themselves suddenly fearing the power that had been unleashed. Harold held on to the shaking fist, but when he looked up at Mia's eyes, what he saw there startled him. "This is hard to describe," he said later. "It was as if you were looking into space through his eyes." For 15 seconds, Mia shook violently as though the coin in his fist controlled him. His eyes grew larger and larger, deeper and deeper, his face now contorted and drained of all blood. "Then, he collapsed at the table," said Harold, his hand opened and the coin fell out. It was black. All the people stood up. Billy was gasping as if he were dead. It was phenomenal. And I sat face to face with him. I could see the reaction on his face. I have never seen anything like it. You can't describe this with words. The hot coin had singed the palm of Mia's hand, causing a blister. When Harold had the coin analyzed, a metallurgist told him that to scorch such metal would require a heat of 1,500 degrees. Gee, another evening, the elders and Stephen sat again in the kitchen, listening to similar stories from people who had seen Mia do things no one could explain. Mia had done so many things no one could explain that the stories had begun to sound the same to the elders. Some people had seen him hold the 20-centime piece between his thumb and index finger and etch his fingerprints into the metal. Elsie had once seen him take a nail 2 to 3 inches long, stand it on its head on the kitchen table, then cup his hand on the table about 8 inches away. In a moment, as though drawn by some irresistible force, the nail had started to dance across the table and vibrated upright all the way into Mia's motionless hand. "When did you realize you had this power?" Britt asked Mia. "When I was a small boy," said Mia. "I started to learn new thinking. For this power of the mind," suggested Lee, "could you use the word magic?" "You see," said Mia, "magic is a word that means only using the power. Nothing else. Only power using. And when did you discover you had magic in your life?" Lee repeated Britt's question. "When I was a small boy." "What did you do?" "I was taught by Svath," said Mia. "He told me how to use everything, how to study to learn." "Could you make things move?" asked Lee, "or put out a candle by thinking about it?" "I was never testing," answered Mia. "I don't know." And then, he told them a brief story. When he was 6 years old and weighed only 55 pounds, his father was constructing a small addition to their house and had asked the young boy to wheel a cart filled with dirt out of a deep hole he had dug under a portion of the house. The cart weighed 2 or 3 times as much as Mia at that young age. But by using the power, he told the elders, he was able to lift the cart with his thoughts and transport it out of the hole. Among the favorite stories told by witnesses who had seen Mia do unexplainable things was the time, during a discussion, he had melted a thick metal spoon in his bare hand. Mia had been stirring his coffee when, to emphasize a point, he raised the spoon out of the coffee and shook it. The raised spoon suddenly had turned to a silver liquid in his hand and dripped onto the table. Several people had seen this. As he listened to this story, Stevens said, "Man, why didn't you save the liquid? Nobody had thought to do that." With the liquid in small puddles on the table, someone had simply wiped it up with a damp cloth. But the story got Stevens thinking out loud. "God," he said, "what we could do with a piece of metal." When Stevens said that, Mia stood up from the table and said, "Just a minute." He walked out of the kitchen and they heard his footsteps heading out to the barn. He came back with this dilapidated, dirty, filthy cardboard box, remembered Lee. And he put it on the kitchen table. Inside, he had brown wrapping paper, and he started opening it. All of us were just hanging over his shoulder. "I asked them to give me a piece of the beam ship," said Mia, "but all they brought me were some metal samples." Lee Elders stood quickly and took 2 pictures, one of Britt helping Mia open the box, and another of Britt and Stevens peering into the box. Inside lay several small packages of brown wrapping paper, and in each package, carefully wrapped, was a sample that Mia claimed had been given to him by the Palladians. "We were in the kitchen there," remembered Elders, "and Mia had just shown us the metal. Bashka was running amok, slamming things against the wall, yelling, trying to get attention. On top of that, a chimney sweep was there, cleaning the chimney. But we had the microphone close to Mia, you can hear what he's saying, and it was real interesting because he said one thing, and that was that this metal is used to make the ship. Mia started to unwrap the little packages, and one after another, out came a small rock specimen, or a crystal, or a shiny fragment of metal. They told me that the metal is in four states, said Mia. Here are the notes I made. In each cubicle, brown and somewhat faded, lay small pieces of paper, Mia's handwritten notes on each of the specimens, describing briefly what each was and from where it came. According to the notes, one of the samples he unwrapped represented the next to the final stage in a seven-step process the Palladians use to make the metal substance that comprise the hull of the beam ships. On the table glistened a half-inch triangle appearing to be an alloy containing silver and gold. Stevens had always told the elders that pictures could be faked, but one thing that could never be faked was a piece of metal exhibiting unusual, possibly unearthly properties. However, this solid kind of evidence rarely accompanied UFO cases. In all of Stevens' experience, such an intriguing piece of evidence had arisen perhaps twice. Yet Mia had been sitting on these specimens for over 3 years, and he had made no attempt whatsoever to use them to sell his story to Stevens to prove he was telling the truth. Stevens had to ask about them specifically. And this was his second trip to see Mia. Again, Stevens learned that with Mia, he had to ask the question or he would never get an answer. Mears gave several metal and crystal samples to Stevens and the elders to have them analyzed back in the United States if they desired. Now, nearing the end of their 5 days in Switzerland, they had many signed witness statements and several items that could be tested in a laboratory by a scientist, photographs, metal samples, sound recordings, and movie footage. It's overkill for us by this time, remembered elders. We've just heard sounds, we've heard all these stories, now he's showing us metal. It's just flat overkill. Steve had been there the year before and he had no idea. None of us had any idea. That Mia had metal specimens, or sounds, or the numerous photographs he had. At the conclusion of their stay, Stevens seemed even more overwhelmed than he had upon completing his first trip to the farm. It's just got to the point where one man couldn't have done so much so well to fool so many people for so long, he said. Just too much for one person to accomplish. Having tried to do a number of these things myself, I realized what was involved in faking a simple picture of a suspended object in the sky. To fake all of the types and kinds of pictures successfully and not be caught, with no confederates, no resources, no equipment, no money, no lab, and a broken camera and one arm, makes it a little bit difficult to believe that the whole thing is a fabrication and a fraud perpetrated by somebody for some reason when there wasn't even an apparent reason. Because of his obvious intelligence and sincerity, the great deal of time he had spent observing Mia, and the resulting confusion in his mind, perhaps the most convincing witness had been Herbert Trunkle. Herbert warned the elders and Stevens that people who had seen only a few of Mia's pictures and then concluded that the object had to be a model and that the case therefore had to be a hoax, just did not understand the reality of the setting in which the story was taking place. These are thoughts always come from people who know nothing about the case, said Herbert. They hear about the case, or they see only one or two pictures. They never go to the place where the pictures were taken. Because people who have seen the places always say, that is not possible. Though a shallow crust of snow remained in large patches on the ground, the elders finally walked one of the sites, the high green bluff at Hastenbull. As he stood on top of the bluff, Lee Elders thought about what Herbert had said. My moment of truth did not come until I walked that site, he said later. I went up to that hilltop where he shot, I'd say, 30% of the best photographs of his collection plus that film, and I knew, right then and there, something was going on, because of the distance involved, because of the terrain, everything about it. We marked 52 yards from where Mia stood to the tree the ship was hovering behind. That's a long distance. You're not going to use small models on that. And there's a drop right behind that tree, added Britt. It just goes straight down. And it's always cold there, continued Lee, wind's always blowing, cold and miserable. Yet he got movie footage on that site and photographs on that site. So that's when I started thinking, okay, so he didn't take them with models, and they are not paste-ups. So what are they? Part 2. The investigation and pictures. See also http://www.billymeitranslations.com/#lightyearspart2.html Part 2. The investigation, called The Sunlight Scene, this photograph, taken March 29, 1976, at Hasenbol, was the last in a sequence of nine that Mia took as the beamship approached from the west. The Hasenbol site, with its radical weather and steep drop behind the tree, impressed the investigators more than any other. Mount Uruti stands in the background to the south of Hasenbol. In Mia's 8mm film of the same scene, a Japanese production crew noticed the sudden brightening of a red light on the ship's flange just above the two red lights that appear here on the bottom of the ship. Calliope and Edouard Mia. A jet fighter on maneuvers with the Swiss Air Force flew into the scene as Mia took this photograph near Schmardul, April 14, 1976. From left to right, Lee Elders, Wendell Stevens, Edouard Mia, and Tom Welch on a hill overlooking the Mia farm. Britt Elders interviews schoolteacher Elsie Moser at the farm in Schmidruti. Physicist Neil Davis of Design Technology in Poway, California, examined this photograph taken August 3, 1975. 3 years later, just beyond the stacks of debarked pine, Mia recorded the beamship sounds analyzed by Los Angeles sound engineers Nils Rognrud and Steve Ambrose. The metal fragment, which represented one of the final stages in the manufacture of the material for the beamship hull, glistens under Marcel Vogel's electron microscope at IBM. The unique sample disappeared while in Vogel's lab. The photograph taken by Austrian schoolteacher Guido Moosbrugger one night while on a contact with Mia, June 13, 1976 taken March 3, 1975. This is the first in a sequence of photographs of a beamship and an accompanying remote-controlled craft. One of the photos in this series appeared on the cover of Europe's Newsweekly Der Spiegel, November 17, 1978. From outside a chicken wire cordon, Mia views landing tracks that appeared below the farm in 1980. In these and other tracks with the same counterclockwise swirls, the crushed grass never turned brown and died, yet it never rose again. 7. And on the clear blue afternoon of June 24, 1947, along the high, snow-covered ridges of Mount Rainier, Washington, a bolt of bright light hit a small mountain plane flown by Kenneth Arnold so suddenly that Arnold thought he was about to collide with another plane. Instead, he spied a formation of nine luminescent objects, bright enough to be seen 100 miles away, skimming the mountain tops at extraordinary speed. Arnold thought he was watching a test flight of new and secret jet planes, but as they came closer, he could see no tails on any of the craft. The strange objects closed at right angles to Arnold's plane, flying like nothing he had ever seen. The echelon formed a pinnacle with the lead craft at the top, the others trailing behind and below, the reverse of military air formations. And their flight was erratic. As Arnold wrote later in his book, The Coming of the Saucers, it was like speedboats on rough water or similar to the tail of a Chinese kite that I once saw blowing in the wind. The craft fascinated him with the way they fluttered and sailed, tipping their wings alternately and emitting those very bright blue-white flashes from their surfaces. Arnold timed the lead craft from the southern edge of Mount Rainier all the way to Mount Adams, a distance of 39.8 miles, which the disc flew in 1 minute and 42 seconds. In the summer of 1947, the fastest experimental aircraft on Earth was thought to be the U.S. Army's X-1, developed by Bell Aircraft Corporation. A bullet-shaped fuselage with a rocket engine, the X-1 was powered to exceed the speed of sound, 760 miles an hour, but no pilot had yet been able to fly it that fast. Chuck Yeager would not break the sound barrier in the X-1 for another 4 months. Yet Arnold's figures, trimmed conservatively, had the shiny metallic discs traveling almost Mach 2, or twice the speed of sound. When Arnold landed in Pendleton, Oregon, he attempted to locate a representative of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, but was unsuccessful.